no helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a cop.
He's listening to you.
How'd you play out there today?
Well, I found the conditions challenging, mostly because there's no grass on the golf course, but there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag, and I had high hopes for the swag bag.
When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trash.
What is happening, folks? Welcome back to the Beltway Golfer Podcast. This is episode 92. I am your host, Alex Dixon. Today's guest is Miss Lauren Greenleaf. She is one of Virginia's most decorated amateur golfers. She's the 2015 U.S. Women's Mid-Am Champ, and we recorded this last week, fresh off another deep run in this year's Mid-Am. Lauren joins us to talk about her impressive consistency in her career, what drives her, and one of the things that fascinates me the most is how she manages to keep her game at an elite level while balancing what sounds like an extremely demanding full-time career off the course. Also learned in our conversation that she does a lot of work with the Virginia State Golf Association, is on their board of competitions. So she's got a really impressive resume, former UVA golfer. The list goes on. Really enjoyed getting a chance to chat with her and learning more about her journey in golf. Going to keep this introduction short, but if you haven't heard, we are launching a magazine. First issue is on track to come out early spring 2026. Stay tuned to beltwaygolfer.com. We're going to do a relaunch of the website for the new year and really kind of focus in on the magazine. Sign up for our newsletter there at beltwaygolfer.com. Follow us on Instagram for updates. But if you've got any stories, if you want to get involved, we put together a team and the first issue is really almost finalized from a content perspective. But this is going to be a twice a year, at least that's the plan for now, twice a year publication. So if you've got stories that need to be told about golfers, golf courses, just golf in general around this region, if you're seeking to be a contributor, reach out. Looking for all sorts of different creatives to help out on this project, but this is really going to be focus on the people, the culture, the history, fun stories that all kind of tie and pertain to golf in this region, in the Mid-Atlantic, Maryland, D.C., Virginia. May stretch beyond that a little bit, but really the focus is obviously going to be this area. That's what we do. Anyway, stay tuned for that. Again, spring of 2026, the first issue will be dropping. So sign up for updates at Beltway Golfer. com. That's it. Let's jump into the podcast. Bear with us a little bit. There's a couple spots in our audio that got a little bit spotty. Overall, I think it came out great and it was a great conversation. So I hope you can stick through it and listen to a lot of the fun stories that Lauren has. That's it. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Again, episode 92. Enjoy. All right. We're here with Miss Lauren Greenleaf. How are you, Lauren?
Doing well. Happy Thursday.
Absolutely. We're recording this and today's the final day of the U.S. Women's Mid-Am. It's the final matches. Has it already started? Because on the West Coast, probably hasn't started for a couple hours, right?
It starts at 9:30 Pacific, so we're about an hour and a half from go time.
An hour and a half. So you were in this tournament. You made match play. One of the things I started to look up, I couldn't go back enough years. How many years in a row has Lauren Greenleaf made match play in this event?
So this was my 10th time playing in the tournament. I won my first outing in 2015, and then they skipped a COVID year. So 10 times playing, and I'm not missed match play yet. So not good for next year.
That is impressive. Well done. So this year's event was at Monterey Peninsula Country Club. Was this your? Had you been out there before? You played it before?
I've played it a number of times. I actually, my connection to Monterey Peninsula is through my swing coach. So I've been working with Blake Thomas for about 4 years now, and we met up at Congressional Country Club where he was one of the teaching pros out there. And I actually work with Casey Edwards for personal training and golf performance out at Congressional.
Sure.
And he connected me with Blake a number of years ago. And then it was probably last May, Blake took the director of instruction job at Monterey Peninsula, which was really good timing to be able to go out there and play a number of weekends before the event. And he actually caddied for me the entire week.
That's pretty cool. So that's just, I assume, a total coincidence that he took the job there. And then I'm sure this was kind of circled on your calendar, knowing that the U.S. Mid-Am was going to be at Monterey Peninsula the following year. That's pretty cool. I didn't know a couple things. One, so Casey Edwards has been on this podcast before he joined Congressional. I didn't know you worked with him. That's awesome. I didn't know, I've met Blake Thomas a couple times, I believe, but I had no idea that he had left Congressional and gone to Monterey Peninsula until you posted that he was caddying for you. I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. So that's that all worked out. How long have you been working with him?
For about 4 years. It started out, I went and wasn't putting very well for a stretch a number of years ago and went and talked to him about some aim point stuff and putting. And that turned into taking a look at my full swing and making a shift and building a plan. And we've been working together ever since.
That's awesome. So you have quite a resume. I was trying to like do some notes for this podcast and trying to like do some bullet points. And every time I, you know, put you in a search bar, there was some other piece of like, oh, wow, Virginia State, you know, Women's Player of the Year 7 times. And I kind of got lost track of it. And so I imagine there's a, you know, plenty of golfers listening to this that are familiar with your game, so to speak. But, you know, let's give kind of an overview. So you're local to the DC area. You live where?
I live in Oakton. So I grew up in Oakton. I've lived here my whole life, played at UVA, and then moved back to Northern Virginia. So I grew up playing at International Country Club in Fairfax, and I'm still there.
You grew up playing there?
I grew up playing there. So I started the junior golf program at International when I was about 4 or 5 years old. So I learned how to play in their Tuesday evening clinic, Wednesday morning play day. And then post-college, I joined as a full member and I've kind of been there my whole life.
Love it. Oh, you played high school golf where?
Oakton High School.
Oakton High School. Were you on the UVA team? Were you heavily recruited to play for UVA?
I was recruited to play nowhere. Really.
Okay.
I played in a U.S. girls junior and a junior PGA, but played more locally in the area. I never played on kind of the AJGA. And for various reasons, the coach change at UVA, some other things going on, I wasn't recruited to play anywhere, but got in as a regular student. I ended up reaching out to Kim Llewellyn, who's the golf coach at the time, and said, hey, I played in this stuff. I would love to try out for the golf team. And they were ranked 4 in the country at the time, had a really strong team. And I don't think Kim really wanted to basically have a random kid come try out. So she kept pushing my tryout back. So we're about 8 weeks into the school year. I didn't have a car. It's not the easiest to get to Birdwood in Charlottesville if you've ever been down there.
Sure.
So I was borrowing my dorm mate's bike. I ride to Birdwood about two or three times a week with 4 clubs over the handlebars just so I could practice and hit balls and stay sharp for my tryout. And then tryout day, I ended up shooting, I think, 1 under of the day, shot a 70, beat a number of the girls on the team. And by the 4th tee, Kim walked up and said, hey, you're on the team. I think they felt a little bad that they were watching me ride my bike back and forth down Ivy Road for a number of weeks. But it ended up working out really well. And I played 4 years at Virginia and played in a couple NCAA tournaments.
Well, did you become a scholarship athlete at some point? Or as soon as you made the team, did that work itself out?
So I started out as a walk-on. And I think the first year, because it was already October, they were so far in the season, I ended up taking a redshirt year. My second year playing, I played in almost all the tournaments. And then by my third and fourth year, I was a 90% scholarship athlete. So it worked itself out and kind of earned my way into that spot.
What years were you at UVA?
I was at UVA 2008 to 2012. And I did a 3+1 program. So I did 3 years of undergrad with a degree in math and economics, and then graduated in 3 and did a 1-year master's in the McIntyre School of Commerce.
So towards the at the end of your career at UVA, was going professional, was that a consideration? How did that decision go?
It was a pretty easy decision for me. Probably the first person to tell you college career was not particularly impressive relative to stuff done post-college. I had a really hard time in college with the mental part of the game and the pressure I put on myself. So college golf is a really interesting sport because it's inherently an individual sport, but you still play as a team. And for most tournaments, they bring 5 people to play for the team. And we had a really strong team at UVA, and I was primarily playing in the 3 through 5 spot. And I just felt a constant pressure to show up at a tournament and play well enough to make it into the lineup for the next tournament, which is not a successful recipe for shooting a good round. It's a lot of pressure on yourself. It's almost similar to going into a tournament and playing to make the cut. Anytime I've ever done that, I've ended up right on the cut line or right outside the cut line. And then after college, I really realized that I'm just playing for me. So So now when I go to a tournament, I play to win the tournament. And it's a much different mindset. And I've been much more successful with it. So my game during college and right at the time I graduated was good enough to make it as a professional. And I had a job offer from Boston Consulting Group. So pretty easy decision for me to start working, but still play amateur golf, but not make it my career.
Sure. That's it. So do you think that kind of struggle on the mental side when you're in college, did a lot of that come from that team aspect? I mean, you're talking about, you know, once you kind of change that mindset that you're just playing for yourself, there's clearly so much pressure. I mean, you can see it, you know, in the Ryder Cup or Solheim, where there's just so much more pressure in that team game. Do you think that's where a lot of it stemmed from?
I don't know if it's playing for the team, because I've played a lot of team competitions since then. I've done quite well in them.
Sure, that was going to be my next question, right?
Yeah, I think it was the just pressure to be in the game, period. So to be in the lineup, to have the opportunity to play for the team, it just felt like constant qualifying. Every single round was a qualifying round, and it was a lot. And then I made some other changes to my game, my golf swing post-college to help me get better. But I think it was really just trying to make the lineup that I had time.
So Boston Consulting Group offered you a job straight out of college. You're still there, correct?
I'm still there. So I've been with BCG for 13 and a half years, and I'm currently a managing director and partner, which is our equity partner role. I got elected to the partnership about 3 years ago and was one of the youngest partners in the world. So I've kind of made a career out of it, but I do most of my work with large retail companies across the country.
That's super impressive. I think one of the things that the average golfer is always kind of fascinated by, especially when you're talking about amateur golf and like high level amateur golf, is, you know, how in the world do these golfers maintain such ridiculous golf games and also have, like, you know, careers, successful careers at the same time? I think clearly it's not the case with you, as you just said. You're one of the you know, youngest executive partners in the globe in your field. I think what a lot of average golfers probably assume is they've got some cush job where they don't have to be there, you know, only have to be there a day or two a week so they can just play golf all the time. How do you kind of balance those both worlds? Obviously, you've got a demanding job. How do you keep your game sharp?
Yeah, I think one of the things I started working is creating the right balance is really important for me. I think when you're fully focused on golf or you're fully focused on work, it's hard to like really feel fulfilled. So I realized early on in my career that I love competing. I love competitive golf. It's not going away. So I've work throughout my career to figure out the best way to do that. So I think a couple things. One is I work really hard on the weekends on my golf game. So I maximize Friday late afternoon to Sunday, spend a lot of time on the course. I've prioritized playing more than grinding on the range. So I do practice on the range, but it's very targeted. So I try and play both Saturday and Sunday and a little bit of nine holes on Friday if I can, because that gives me a good idea of sharp what I need to work on and what I need to focus on the range, because I don't have unlimited time. I think from a golf perspective, I found post-college, building the right team around you is really important. It's hard to just go out there and do it yourself. So I mentioned Casey is my strength coach. I've been working with him probably for 8 years now at this point. I've always had a swing coach, have a chiropractor, a physical therapist. So I think building the right team around you to help you be successful in elite level is really important. And then from a work side, I travel a lot in my career. So I think last year I took 135 flights, which is pretty typical, to go see my client. So during the week, if I'm traveling, I don't get to play at all. I try and do fitness still, but don't get to touch a club. But throughout my career, I found various avenues to get to play. So prior to being elected as a partner, every odd number of year, I took about 3 months off in the summer and took an unpaid leave of absence through various programs at BCG and was able to just kind of take a 3 month block and go play and focus on golf, which I think let me be successful at BCG because I came back refreshed and energized. That let me really focus on golf and build an amateur career along the way. So that was a unique element of my setup that let me play and focus a little bit.
That is a staggering amount of flights. How do you manage that when, you know, if you're flying that much? I mean, when I fly, my back stiffens up, you know, I eat too much, you know, let alone maintaining, you know, a elite level golf game, just maintaining health and just general, like, minimal fitness. And I fly just to, you know, two or three times a year, not 120 or whatever you just said. What are some secrets to kind of balancing that aspect of it? It was just like constantly traveling. And I imagine you're in hotel rooms all the time.
I'm in a lot of hotel rooms. I think for me, it's about creating structure. So I'm a very scheduled person. I love living on my calendar. I like knowing when things are going to happen. So I try and make sure I get up and I work out early in the morning, because at least I found for me, if it doesn't happen in the morning, it's not going to happen at night. Sure. I'm going to be hungry or working or something else.
Yeah.
So I just try and make sure I get up and do my fitness and get on a routine. But once you do it for a little bit, you kind of get used to all the flights. It's too bad.
Yeah. So back to career. So we finished off after you left UVA. Did you kind of immediately jump into or continue playing like big time tournaments right after graduating college, amateur tournaments?
So I graduated in May of 2012 and I started working at Boston Consulting in August of 2012. So I think I took 8 months off. I was still playing every weekend at international with my buddies. Women's amateur golf coming out of the summer season and early fall, I wasn't a mid-am yet. So there's really not much to play in until kind of May the following year. So I took a couple months and then restarting in summer of 2013, I started playing tournaments again.
Got it. And then, so by the time you hit 25, when you're eligible for the mid-am, do I have it right? So when you went down to, is it Squire Creek, in 2015, mm-hmm. was that your first eligible U.S. women's mid-am and you took home the title? Do I have all that right?
It was. So I turned 25 in September of 2015, and the tournament at Squire was actually a little later that year. It was in early October, which was helpful for me because I would say most years the mid-am falls right around my birthday. So if it was in the normal time frame, I may have not been able to compete that year, but it was in October. So I went to Delaware for qualifying. It's the only qualifier I've ever had to play, thankfully, for the mid-am. So went and qualified in Delaware and then flew down to Squire in October 2015. And I think I'm still the youngest champion ever. I was about 25 and 3 weeks old when I won.
And had to qualify in. That is impressive. And now you've made match play every single time since. That's a remarkable run. Have you competed at the same, you know, since then, have you continued to enter the overall U.S. Women's Am, or are you just really focused on Mid-Am at this point?
I play both of them. So throughout my career, I think I've played in 9 U.S. Women's Amateur Championships. I didn't play this year, didn't play particularly well in my qualifier. Last year, I played at Southern Hills in Oklahoma from 9th. So I try to do both. I try and play the U.S. Women's Open qualifier because it's one of my goals is to make it to the U.S. Women's Open. Now for winning the mid-am, there's an exemption into the Open, but there wasn't in 2015 when I won, which is kind of unfortunate. And I've been really close through qualifying at times, haven't quite got in. So that's kind of on my bucket list too.
Sure, I bet. So, but even now, because we haven't even got into yet some of the state stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia State Women's Play of the Year 7 times, which is remarkable. There can't be that many folks in any state, men or women, that have 7 state players of the year. You still keep a fairly busy schedule. I mean, just anecdotally, I obviously don't know your whole schedule, but you know, you won the Virginia Women's Am. You went up to New York and won the Farrell Cup, I believe it's called, on Long Island. You just played in the U.S. Mid-Am. You're still keeping a fairly busy golf schedule, right?
I try and play about 10 tournaments a year. And kind of the way I think about it is I start with the national events. So the U.S. Women's Mid, hopefully the U.S. Women's Am, the four ball if I'm able to qualify, which I haven't for the last couple years. Then I move down to state stuff. So I've been actually on the board of directors, the Virginia State Golf Association. I'm in my 7th year on the board now.
Fantastic.
And I chair all of women's competitions for the board. So that's something that's near and dear to my heart, growing the women's game in Virginia and trying to make those tournaments the best they can possibly be. So I prioritize all the state events. So the women's four ball, the AM, state open, and state mid-AM. 2 of those tournaments I help to get off the ground. So they're pretty important to me. So I prioritize all of those. And then there's a host of national and regional events in the women's mid-AM game at some pretty cool clubs that I try and play in every year to try and grow the events and support them. So I play the Amateur Golf Alliance Women's Amateur in early in the season in the spring. The Farrell, which I was lucky enough to win this year, is a kind of prestigious, but prestigious match event, National Invitational for Women and Men. We play this week with them, which is pretty fun. That's at Stagecoach Club in Connecticut. And then I play a couple other regional events as well.
That's a I was unaware that you you were on the board of the Virginia State Golf Association and led some and led a handful of the women's tournaments. Does anyone? I mean, is there any kind of balance there when you're involved in are you involved in setting up the Virginia women's AM or the Virginia Open and then competing in it as well? Does anybody ever kind of be like give you any crap for that?
Not any crap. I try and bring the voice of the player. So. Sure. The staff is really great and they know what they're doing. They're world class. Every once in a while, I'll take a look at the tee boxes or some of the pin locations and just give my thoughts and suggestions, mainly around just making the course fun, making it be more playable. So one of the things I've been focused on from a course set perspective is we make it fun and engaging, which place up Virginia Men's AM. So as an example, in men's golf, with everyone hitting it so far, typically you'll see a number of reachable par fives. In women's golf, because you can keep pushing there's room to push the tee boxes back. It's every once in a while, I'll show up to a tournament, and there'll be four par fives, and they'll all be 545 yards, which isn't that much fun as a competitor. Right. Three-shot hole, you have a 100-yard wedge shot at the end. So I look for stuff like that, just where we can make match play more exciting, where we can bring in birdies or tough holes or just knowledge of the course on landing areas. I'll try and jump in and offer thoughts on that. But really, the staff owns the setup and they do a great job of it.
You said you've been on the board for 7 years on a state competitive level, but kind of golf as a whole, that was kind of when golf was going through a dip right before this massive kind of rebound due to COVID. I'm curious, have you seen a lot of changes from the competitive amateur level, like at the state level or even on the national level? With this kind of explosion in golf and especially specifically in women's golf, what are some changes that you've seen over the last 5-10 years?
I think the trajectory of golf has certainly shifted. When I joined the board, it was always a discussion of kind of declining membership numbers, fewer people with handicaps, trying to figure out kind of who we were losing and why. And then COVID really just was an inflection point where golf started to grow again, which I think is really exciting for the game. I think a lot of the growth isn't coming from kind of the top competitive level, though we've seen fields continue to get stronger. There's a lot of growth at the entry point of the game. So folks that are newer to the game, folks that are returning to the game that haven't played in a long time. So I think from a VSJ perspective, I also lead our Golfer Advancement Initiative, which focuses on growing the game in a couple specific areas. One is youth on course, dramatically growing that program, military golf, golf, which is something that I've invested a lot of time in the last couple of years at the Virginia Adaptive Golf Programs off ground, which is pretty exciting. And then junior girls golf and the Fleming Fund sending some first tee girls to golf camps around the state, which is really exciting. I think a lot of the focus has been around creating programming for players at kind of different stages in the game, whether it's high-end competition, folks that are brand new to the game and trying to learn and stay. And then it's really at every level, which has been a fun challenge and fun kind of project to work on the last couple of years.
With this kind of influx of golfers, that's interesting. I think you're absolutely right when you say that it's really the huge growth is the people just getting into golf, maybe not necessarily the intense, serious, competitive golfers. There was not necessarily a dip prior to COVID, and there probably hasn't been a ton more. I would imagine there's some. Just sticking with the VSGA, have you guys expanded? Like with this kind of growth in golf, has there been an expansion on kind of the higher end of competitive golf? Has there been any like tournaments added or more opportunities for the competitive golfer to compete?
Yes, I think the two tournaments that come to mind, there's been more events added on the women's side of the schedule, which I'm really excited about. So we added a women's state open. It's been played. This was the third year this year at Farmington. So we got that tournament off the ground 3 years ago with a sold out field. So we started with a field of 72. I think we've up to 80 something every year now, rep weight lifts and get a great collection of players from the Mid-Atlantic, college kids, juniors, M's as well. So that's one that I'm really proud of. And then we started a Virginia Women's Mid-Amateur right around the same time. So it's been played 3 years as well, because in the VSGA side, there was not a women's mid-amateur like they had for the men. So getting these couple additional events up and going has been really exciting.
That's great. So moving back to your career, I'm getting the sense, you know, you won the U.S. mid-am. You know, you talked about maybe some of your struggles at UVA. Has your game, and certainly it sounds like from the mental side, but just your game overall seems to improved with age. Is that accurate? Is that fair?
It has. It's not a straight upward progression. There's always some setbacks and always trying ups and downs. But I think I've steadily continued to improve. I've worked really hard to rethink my golf swing. It's like almost 4 years ago, to continue to think about how much short game can be better. I really like to anchor. I'm using a broomstick putt right now, a lap sweeper, to try something different. So I'm always trying to get better. And I think that's what makes the game exciting and what keeps me interested. So I think if I just didn't work on anything, I'd get bored. So the constant kind of strive to get better is something that I think keeps me in the game and keeps me excited about it.
Is Blake Thomas your de facto mental coach as well? Or do you have a separate mental coach?
I don't have a separate mental coach. It's something I've thought about getting. I just try and stay kind of cool, calm, and collected on the golf course. I think when I was a little kid playing, I used to get really upset when I hit bad shots, and it never makes it better. I just try and stay pretty level-headed and pretty calm on the golf course.
Sure. What about International Country Club? Can you tell some listeners more? It sounds like you've been a member there for most of your life, if not all of your life. Tell us a little bit about it. It seems like they've got a great program. I know, I hope I don't butcher their last names, but the Duong Minh Ee brothers, are they members at International Country Club? Also, both played at UVA?
They are, and you're pretty close on their name. I've known them since they were little kids. I remember watching them play in the PGA Junior League in their orange jerseys, and Josh Duong Minh Ee, who is the one that's currently playing on the UVA team, he used to sit out on the driving range and just eat Skittles and talk to people. As I've got to watch them grow up in golf, which is pretty fun. We've had a great junior program at International. So when I was growing up playing, there were two other female players, Amanda Steinhagen and Shabril Brewer, now Durko, right around the same age as me. And they've both had pretty good golf careers. Shabril played at James Madison. Amanda played at Longwood and won a couple VSGA women's amateurs. I think strong history at International of just good junior players. And it was a great place to learn the game. I still play all the time there. And even though I play elite level national tournament, I still try and enter all the club tournaments on the weekends. This Saturday, I'm actually playing in the finals of our year-long net match play event, playing from the 6,400-yard tee box. And it's a 128-person match play bracket, 100% handicap that starts in April every year.
Oh, wow.
So I somehow made the final again. I'm giving many, many strokes.
I was
going
to say,
round.
Do you get a side eye when you get entered because, you know, they know your resume?
I don't think I've ever received strokes in any of these matches. I'm given a lot of pops every round, but I love competing. And I think being able to compete even at the club level helps to keep my game sharp. So it's something that I always put on my calendar as well.
Sure. I'm always fascinated. So do you, like, what is your handy, if you're willing to share, what is your gin right now?
Yeah, so there's a conversion between men's and women's handicaps just based on difference in tee boxes and how we hit it. And so I right now I'm a women's plus 5.5, which converts to about a plus one men's handicap from there.
Got it. Yeah, so I imagine you're giving an awful lot of strokes on the local level at ICC. What else? So another curious one I'd love to hear about, just because I think you're the first person I've ever spoke to that's competed in one. The Walker Cup got so much attention this year being at Cypress Point, but you've played in at least one, you tell me, Curtis Cups. Tell me about the Curtis Cup.
So I've never played in the actual Curtis Cup. It's one of my bucket list items that I'd still like to accomplish at some point in my career. But in 2019, I took 4.5 months off work to try and make a bid to make the Curtis Cup team in 2020. And it would have been the first time a female mid-am has made the Curtis Cup in a long time. So in the Walker Cup on the men's side, there's 10 spots on the team. There's typically a dedicated mid-am spot.
Right.
We don't have that on the women's side yet. It would be great to see in the future, but there's only 8 slots on the team. So there's not a dedicated minnow spot. Took a bit of time off in 2018 at the court final, the U.S. Women's AM, and having that on the resume was part of the reason why I wanted to make a deep run for Curtis Cup. So I played a really strong 2019. I made the semifinals at the U.S. Women's Mid-Am in Flagstaff, Arizona. And then I was invited to play on the Curtis Cup practice team in December of 2019. And what the practice squad is they select about 12 players from the U.S. side, and you all meet for about 4 days in December, and you go play and practice and get to know each other. And it generally, a lot of the ultimate team comes from that practice squad. So we were at Lob Lolly down in Hope Sound, Florida, and you play a whole bunch of different formats in that weekend with different players. So you play foursomes, you play four ball, you play singles, but had a great time at the practice session, hit it really well, and was looking forward to possibly making a run for the team in 2020. And then obviously COVID happened, which was devastating for my Curtis Cup bid because they ended up not putting the Curtis Cup in 2020 and pushing back a year. And they changed the algorithm for the World Amateur Golf Ranking System. Moved me from being ranked about 110 to 300 overnight when they changed the algorithm. It was a devastating course of events. It's still something that I'm pretty bummed out about, but still motivated to try and hopefully make a team in the future.
Well, then I certainly obviously apologize for my failed research and having to bring that up. The internet let me down on that one. That's an interesting story, though. That's kind of
wild. I did play on the American Concession Cup team, though, last year, which is pretty exciting.
Okay, where was that?
So the Concession Cup has been around, I think, 5 or 6 playing for the men, but it's the mid-am version of the Curtis Cup and Walker Cup. So it's run by an organization called the Amateur Golf Alliance, which also runs the Women's Championship. And every other year, a set of mid-ams and seniors from the U.S. plays the top mid-am and seniors from Europe in the same style format. So it's foursomes, four singles. So it was previously a men-only event, and they added women to the program last year, played in Savannah, Georgia at the Landings Club. But it was definitely an honor to be a part of the inaugural team for women. So it was 6 female mid and 6 seniors. And we beat Europe in the first playing. So did have the opportunity to do that one, which was really exciting.
As when you're playing in amateur events, you know, you're not getting paid for these events. You've got a demanding job. Obviously, these are prestigious events. Some of them are run by the USGA or the MGA or the VSGA. So there's a level of prestige, but they're not necessarily growing your bank account. Not that that's necessarily the motivation, but you know, going forward, like what is, you know, playing amateur golf, like what keeps you motivated? How long do you think you can keep doing it, or is that just, you know, love the game? You're gonna do it as long as you can.
I definitely love the game. I love the game more now than I did when I was playing in college. I was a junior and I could play all the time. I'm very Type A and competitive by nature, so I think just the ability to continue to compete and compete at a high level is something that fuels me and I really enjoy. Like even reflecting on coming back from the mid-am, I played a ton of golf this week and I came back and I played yesterday and I'm a little sad that I don't compete again until January. So I'm a competitive person by nature. So it's what I really like doing. And then I've always set a number of long-term golf goals that help keep me motivated. So I have a goal to win a senior U.S. Women's Amateur and make a rock winning a U.S. Senior Women's Open when I turn 50. 15 years, I definitely have serious long-term goals I'm working toward.
I love that. It's a great goal. I feel like every golf hack, male or female, kind of has the same goal, but it's obviously wildly unrealistic for 99.9% of golfers. But for you, I think that's it could be an attainable goal. I had one question for you, a few more to hit on here, but one that seems to be in the news a little bit, especially after the tournament on the med side that just happened a week or two ago, where a former professional won an elite amateur event. And so a lot of the chatter online has been about should former professionals who maybe did not succeed. I think this is more a case on the men's side, but I don't know if maybe it happens on the women's side a little bit too, where folks that haven't really been successful as professional golfers go back and get reinstated as amateurs and then are competing in amateur events and winning mid-ams and so on and so forth. What is your stance or take on all that?
I think much more common on the men's side, where you look at the men's mid-am field or any of these elite invitationals, a vast majority of the field had tried to be a professional at one point or another. On the women's side, I was actually talking to someone about this at the mid-am this week, so it's very top of mind. Becoming more common, but it's not an overwhelming amount of the field. I think my personal take on it is, like, it makes the amateur game stronger. So I do think folks should have to sit out for a couple years before they get their AM status back. They made a decision to go pro, knowing everything they knew. They went and chased it. That's great. I think as long as they sit out a couple years, it's fine to me. I do think if you're kind of winning tournaments on the highest level, so you've won multiple LPGA events, you had your PGA Tour card for a decade or two or whatever, that feels like a little bit of a different case. So I do think, to me, it's at least a sliding scale of like how long you were on tour, how successful you were, and how long it should take you to get your status back.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, it seems like that's a lot of the comments and stuff that you see online. You know, it seems the folks that are really on the outside looking in, maybe the folks that aren't playing in these tournaments, want it to be hard and fast rule. If you've ever been a professional, then you should not be allowed. But some of the voices that are actually playing these events, like someone like yourself, understand that every case is a little bit different.
Yeah, you have to look at it individually. I think my just general philosophy is continuing to make amateur and mid-amateur golf stronger, I think it's the right thing to do for the game. So if we can get back into the golf and the fields are stronger, that's great. We all just need to raise our level of competition.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on just kind of the women's game in general, like even the professional game? One of the reasons I ask is another thing that's been in the news the last couple of days is that the LPGA is in China this week, and all of a sudden all over the news is how the course doesn't look in the best shape. And so I'm curious, how do you think women's professional golf or amateur golf has made strides in these last 5-10 years when you're looking at this big boom in golf? Or are they mm-hmm. still... Is there still a long way to go to get the respect they deserve?
I think it's definitely improved. I think there's still room to improve on a number of fronts. But I think one thing that's very evident to me is that just the depth of the women's professional game has increased dramatically. The number of players that can win week in, week out, the bottom of the field is much stronger than it used to be. Outside of the conditions this week, I think in both women's amateur golf and professional golf, the level of venues has raised, which I think is really important. An example being, like, we were at MPCC this week for the women's bid. Like, that's an incredible event and something that course is definitely a draw to a number of top players. I think looking at the schedules for the women's USAM, women's mid-am in the years to come, there's some pretty darn good venues on those sites. I think that's one thing that's dramatically improved. I think especially with Mike Wan taking over the USGA and focusing on that side. I think on the women's professional side, a lot of really interesting stories in the game right now. A lot of exciting players come out and about. So I think Rose Zhang winning her first LPGA event at the Mizuho at Liberty National a couple years ago. I remember I was actually coming back from a tournament of my own, and I watched the entirety of the last round trying to see if Rose could win. And she's on the Curtis Cup practice squad with me, and I've interacted with her a bunch. Nelly Korda obviously is very exciting. Lauren Coughlin from the state of Virginia is exciting to me as a teammate. We actually played an exhibition match against each other at Keswick a few weeks ago.
Oh, that's cool.
Which was pretty fun. So I think there's a lot of great stories out there. I think there's still work to do, especially on the LPGA side, around how do we bring those stories to the limelight and the forefront and tell them in a way that's compelling to audiences. So I still think there's some work to do there, but there's definitely a positive trend in elevating the women's game, which is something that I'm really excited about.
Can you give me and the listeners maybe a couple other local names? Ladies that should be on our radar that are outstanding golfers from this region.
Yeah, at any level in competitive golf, at any level.
I mean, I think LPGA. We the professional golfers we know, but maybe some up and coming. Like I know another mid am that I think I follow. She's on the other side of the beltway. Claire Connolly, I know, is an outstanding golfer. But I don't follow a ton of local women's golfers. I probably should know more. I'm just curious if there's any that maybe aren't on people's radar that we should know about.
Yeah, Claire Connolly is a good one. I was with Claire this week and spent a bunch of time with her. She is someone you actually just want to like sit down and have a drink with and talk to after the round. because she will certainly put a smile on her face and has some great stories. Midam-wise, there's another woman, Midam Alexander Austin, who plays on Springfield. We've seen a lot of ball events together. First one of the national scene last year at Braeburn, making the quarterfinals while being 5.5 months pregnant with her son, Xander, earlier this year. So she's around. And then at the junior level, the one I would watch is Zoe Cusack, who plays out of Congressional, just played in the Junior Ryder Cup, was runner-up to Astris Tally at the Junior PGA, and is going to be a fellow Wahoo next year, is heading to
UGA. Oh, really? Oh, cool. Excellent.
They're in the area.
Yes, she's on my radar. I did not know that about she's playing on UVA next year. What are just some you know, sticking to the DMV, being the Beltway Golfer podcast here. You have some outside of International Country Club. Do you have some other favorite courses in the region that when you're not playing International Country Club, you excited to play?
We have a lot of good ones here. My favorite golf round in the DMV is probably playing RTDA in the afternoon in the fall. When you get the sunset out over the lake and it's not crowded, you can just buzz around and hit golf shots. That's probably my favorite round of golf. I haven't done it yet this year, but I've played a lot of sunset rounds at RTJ. I always like going out to play at Riverbend. I won the Virginia Women's Amateur there last year. That's probably one of the oldest ones in the field. I think everyone I played in match play was 17 or younger. but always like playing at Riverbend and then across the river. I really enjoy playing Woodmont. Both courses, I think, are really fun. Played the U.S. Women's Am there in 2020 during the COVID year. But I think it's a great facility. Obviously, Congressional is great. I spend a bunch of time there. Sure. But we are blessed in this area to have a ton of great courses. I was talking to Claire this week. I'm trying to get out to Chevy Chase and see the new layout because that one just opened up again.
Yeah, I talked to someone just yesterday that played it, and they said it was fantastic and felt like an entirely new golf course. So I have not seen the redo yet, but it sounds fantastic. You first mentioned RTJ. Did you get to spend a lot of time out at the Solheim when it was there last year?
I went to Sunday and watched Sunday Sigils. I think I maybe was at the U.S. Women's Mid-Am last year, earlier in the week, or is that another big tournament? So I didn't make it out until Sunday. But it was a really cool experience. I think the vibe on the first tee with the music playing was really exciting. It was fun to go watch Lauren compete and play for the U.S. And then it was a great collection of golf. I think my big standout was just walking around grounds. I feel like every 30 seconds I would bump into someone that I knew and recognized and got to catch up with. So I think it was a great celebration of golf, and they did a great job at that event.
Yeah, that's what I find so exciting about when there's big time tournaments around here. You know, even someone like myself, who's, you know, I'm not a competitive golfer. I don't have the connections that somebody you have, but just from doing Beltway Golfer, I run into, you know, people that have been on the podcast and people that have, you know, conversed with online. And all of a sudden, like when there's a big event, whether it's Solheim or something at the Congressional or the BMW up at Caves or even some of the live events that have happened, you know, it's like the entire golf community comes out and you're just like bumping into people left and right, which is fantastic. You said your next competitive event was in January. What is that event?
So in January, I'm teeing it up in the Women's International Four Ball. So it is a four ball event that has been around forever. Probably, I don't know how many years it's been, but if you look at the prior champions list, it's pretty impressive, but it's played in Ocala, Florida. So I'm teaming up with Jackie Rogowitz, who's a member of Marion and Philly. We teamed up last year and came in second. So we are going to give it another go this year.
Here's one more question for you, because I actually got a golf trip of mine coming up. I mean, you play so much golf, you travel so much for work. Do you do recreational golf trips?
I wish I did. It's something I want to do more of in the next decade. Between work and competing, I don't have a lot of extra weeks. Do you get to South Carolina in the winter? So excited that I didn't want to do Virginia winters anymore. I relocated to Hillhead, South Carolina for 3 months in the wintertime to play. I'm a member of Chichese Creek Club down there, which is a great Core Crenshaw course. I do a little bit of just recreational golf around Hilton Head all winter to be down there. But at some point, I would like to do some more golf trips.
Well, that's a nice place to winter. I'm envious. Well, this has been great. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Your resume is extremely impressive. And congratulations on making the match play for 10th year in a row at the U.S. Women's Mid-Am. And congratulations on all the work you're doing.
Thank you very much for the invite. This is a lot of fun.